Welcome to today's seminar, called To Be or Not To Be, Working with Cluster B Personalities. I'll be your presenter for the seminar on Cluster B Personalities, and my name is Michelle Sparks. Now, today is designed to be an overview about the qualities to look for, treatments to be aware of, and just some general foundations on Cluster B Personality Disorders. After we go through the overview, I've included a few different role-played case scenarios of hypothetical cluster Bs and how you could work with some of their difficulties. I wanted that to be the crux of today so you could see the applications of some of the actual skills, since that seems to be a frustration point for many. When we're talking about cluster B personalities, we're talking about personalities that are things like narcissism, antisocial, borderline, and histrionic personalities. You'll see throughout today's seminar that there's quite a bit of overlap in terms of some of the symptomology. That's why they're considered clustered together or in a group. There's different clusters of personality disorders, but this cluster B personality disorder has a lot of emotional components, drama to it, a lot of attention seeking. You'll see some similarities between a number of these disorders, although there are several differences as well. Keep in mind, as we're talking about personality disorders, we're talking about long-term, pervasive ways of coping with life. Anyone could have some of these symptoms when they're under stress. Maybe they look dramatic, maybe they look attention-seeking, maybe they look like they're self-focused, or they're dramatic, or they're focusing on certain aspects of things where there's emotional dysregulation. But we're talking about someone who, across a number of different situations, different scenarios, different environments, has tended to persist in these personality attributes. Oftentimes, we'll see that the attributes of any of these cluster B personalities begin developing even at a young age. I always mention to clients that when they're coming in and they're talking about presenting concerns and desired for changes in behavior, that we need to look at and explore how doing these certain behaviors up to this point has felt like an advantage. People wouldn't continue to have certain personality attributes if they hadn't been reinforced, either by their biology, their neurochemistry, their environment, or a combination of all those above. So, as we're talking with a client who has cluster B personality disorders, we're looking at their orientation to life, what's been reinforced, how they tend to deal with life. Let's start first with a narcissistic personality disorder. This is an issue of self-admiration. This person really tries to over-idealize themselves. But when you look at a deeper level on their relationships, you see a shallowness sometimes about them. There tends to be a hyper-individuality on this person. They tend to magnify their accomplishments and have a great deal of pride in accomplishments. It's not that sometimes they've not done actual accomplishments, but they're so hyper-focused on those to the point that there's a grandiose self-image. They neglect the two-way nature of relationships because they're so focused on getting their need for admiration met. A lot of times you'll have people that are in relationships with someone with a narcissistic personality that initially found that person to be so attractive, charming, have such a great sense of humor, so likable, so accomplished, but over time have felt like, gosh, they're not even getting their needs met because it's become all about the narcissistic person. Narcissistic persons oftentimes shun emotional displays, and they don't like a whole lot of sensitivity in things. There's some core themes that the literature would suggest that people with narcissistic personality disorder might have. One of the core themes is perfectionism. They like things done right. They like them consistently done right and well. And right and well is what they perceive as being advantageous to them. It's not necessarily what meets a need for the community or for the other person. They have a sense that they really genuinely are superior. And where there seems to be a breakdown in their relationships is when they feel devalued. A lot of times we get the question about, can you really work with someone who's narcissistic? Can you even really do counseling with them? The fact of the matter is that it's pretty rare for a narcissist to actually come into counseling for narcissistic personality disorder, but a lot of times they'll come in because they're having, quote, relationship stress, because they feel misunderstood, because they feel like their relationship isn't a partnership anymore, that their needs aren't getting met. They feel like they're doing all the right things, the good things, but their spouse just doesn't see it. So they have difficulty with feeling devalued. It's interesting and it's kind of ironic that on the one hand, they portray this sense of confidence, even overconfidence and superiority, but there's such a deep vulnerability. There's a sense that they're ready to shatter if they feel devalued. There's difficulty that they have acknowledging and sharing subjective experiences. They really do fear loss of status, affiliation, and support. One of the things the literature suggests in terms of when you're counseling someone with narcissism is to ask their perception on things. Believe me, they have an answer. They have a perspective. It makes sense to them. It makes sense why they're so frustrated because people just don't love and understand them as they should. So questions that work with narcissists, what do you think happened? How do you see the problems from your perspective? What makes it possible for you to feel valued and competent and meet your goals? What I like about that last question is that it's very behavioral. So we can work with a narcissist on, okay, we can't make all the people in your life do exactly what you want them to do to meet your needs, but what can you do to get those needs met yourself? So they've actually looked in the last 10 years here at possibly making some changes to the narcissistic personality disorder diagnosis. They looked at proposed changes such as identity, self-direction, and impairments, and empathy or intimacy being the components of narcissism. If these changes were made, for example, identity would include difficulty of having reference to others, that others are supposed to help them define themselves and regulate their self-esteem. Another aspect of identity that would be highlighted in these proposed changes would be exaggerated self-appraisal and difficulties with emotional regulation. The second category that we talk about in terms of proposed changes would be self-direction. Basically, that this person with a narcissistic personality disorder diagnosis focuses on goals of getting approval from others. They will spend a great deal of time trying to surround themselves with people who will admire them. I remember, for example, there was one gentleman I assessed who had narcissistic personality disorder, but also was a substance user. And I remember particularly it was an opiate narcotic use. And I remember him coming in and saying, well, I don't know why she, the woman I live with, doesn't appreciate me. I'm basically on my hands and knees mopping her floors for her. Sure, I don't have a job. Sure, I don't do what she does. But I'm worth a whole lot more to her. I'm the most handsome guy in the Narcotics Anonymous group. There's other women who would love me and want to be with me. She doesn't see what she has. She doesn't realize this. So a lot of comparison, and again, an exaggerated sense of importance, unreasonably high standards, and they're often not aware of what really motivates them. There's really not genuine intimacy when you're talking about a narcissist. What happens is oftentimes you'll see in many of these cluster B personality disorders that there's an intensity that they start in relationships. That when they start, wow, you know, it could be the physical intimacy, the sexuality, the intensity, the charisma, the being around this other person really is like a thrill. But then when that subsides, oh boy. So the grandiosity is fed initially. Initially, when you have someone in a relationship with a narcissist, wow, that feeling of entitlement they have, sure, they're getting it reinforced. People think they're special. People like their work, their accomplishments. The self-centeredness continues to be reinforced. The belief that they are special, that they're more intelligent, that they're more capable, really gets reinforced. There's attention and admiration seeking, where you see there's great attempts at being the center of attention. When we talk about symptom severity, that narcissists have difficulty understanding the mind states of others. Empathy is a huge, difficult area for them. A lot of times when we think of lack of empathy, we think of another cluster B personality disorder, antisocial disorder. But oftentimes we haven't always thought about that with a narcissist. The fact of the matter is the narcissist is so wrapped up in getting his or her needs met, the needs for affirmation, that they just really, honestly, according to the research, don't pay attention to what's going on with others. So, really, if you want to find a relationship that works, even though it's toxic, for a narcissist, would be a relationship between a narcissist and a codependent. The codependent likes to fix and help and really is other-focused. And the narcissist is oftentimes equally not other-focused. So it really works out, although in a toxic way. When we talk about symptom severity with narcissists, we talk about low levels of emotional empathy and high levels of cognitive empathy. Now that's interesting. They can see things factually and explain them with their quote-unquote advanced intellect. But to actually do the emotional connections, another thing. They have difficulty relating to others and putting themselves in someone else's shoes. Wonder why that would be. Well, because that would require them to actually believe that they're not more special than other people. That maybe there's some commonalities with other people. There's some interesting resources and books out there about narcissism. And one highlights the relationships that narcissists tend to be in. Rosenberg, in 2013, talked about what I just described with the dynamics of a narcissist or an emotional manipulator, as he would call it, in a relationship with someone who's more like a codependent. So at the severe end, the narcissist would be someone who is unable to really care for others. They're so self-absorbed, it is not even in their mind about what others might want or need. This works when you have a relationship with a codependent, because at the extreme end, the codependent is completely absorbed with caring for the other. They're powerless. They're not able to receive from the other. Oftentimes, the codependent will say that they feel their mission in life is to help and care for others. And, of course, the narcissist is just all too ready to be cared for. Now, the narcissist, over time, could become a little less self-absorbed, but we see at the severe end that they can be easily angered if their needs are not met. Codependents find that they have to resort to sometimes indirect ways of trying to get their needs met. They may become emotional and tearful. They really will jump through hoops to try not to upset others. They won't ask for their needs. But it's exactly the opposite with the narcissist. They prefer to be in charge in relationships. They're the go-getter. But it is possible. I don't want to make it sound like a narcissist can't ever learn skills. It is possible to teach behaviors that are more two-way in terms of relationships. To teach a balance between giving and receiving with a narcissist and codependent. It's not necessarily easy to do. And again, these are long-term patterns. They take time to change. Both the codependent and the narcissist tend to have their symptom origins in childhood. Both are long-term and pervasive. While the codependent's trying to figure out the rules so they're not hurting others, the narcissist is sensitive to anything that might produce rage and defensiveness and interrupt the way that they think people should treat them. They both use defense mechanisms to avoid rocking the boat for the other. So how would we approach a treatment with a narcissist if we were able to work with them? One of the things that's difficult, since they avoid focusing on emotions, is to teach self-expression. Teaching them to identify feelings, to identify feeling states in themselves, first of all. We'd have to actually teach them empathic responding. And for a narcissist, it may be that we have to teach them this behavior tends to mean this feeling. This is what it means for your partner. And having to look in terms of behavior, because sometimes it's hard for them to pay attention to the cues. Other things like conflict management, how to do discussions and negotiations can be big issues for them. The idea of changing, they can perceive as defeat rather than just looking that everyone changes and makes adjustments, that it's not that they're a flawed person that's going to fall apart, but that it's making accommodations, both them and the other person they're in relationships with. We can help them with communication skills. So there's a lot of things that we can look at. One of the things the literature suggests is particularly important in terms of working with narcissists is teaching expressor and listener interchanges. Literally, we are doing something very methodical with them. So we're giving them a formula. From my point of view, I feel blank when blank happens. Such and such behavior is what I would like in the future. What's nice with that is it's short, it's to the point, it's concise. It's not a lot of deep feelings, but it really helps them self-evaluate. Then they can move on to making a behavioral request. We can look at how reasonable or unreasonable that behavior request is. And we can process with the narcissist. What would it mean to him or her if the request was granted or if it wasn't granted? The listener can focus on hearing and perspective taking from the other rather than just arguing his or her points. The listener should lay aside judgment and prepare to communicate understanding, not necessarily agreement. One of the exercises the literature talks about as being useful when you're doing systems work with a narcissist and with the people that they're in relationships with is to actually have them and the other person write a love letter. That's not something that's genuinely directly experienced oftentimes when people are in a relationship with a narcissist. They have a struggle affirming sometimes other people unless it's insofar as the other person's lifting them up. So when we're talking about couples or family interchanges, we're talking about addressing narcissistic vulnerability, which includes defensiveness and narcissistic gratification. We're talking about foundational relationship skills, like the communication I just mentioned. The fact is, when couples have come to therapy, in some studies, that they've actually shown 60% improvement in the couple's relationship beyond the therapy. And when they've done long-term follow-up, as much as 40% improvement. These are pathological narcissists. So there is some literature out there that if we are delicate and sensitive and pace out with very appropriate timing some of the skills, that we may be able to really work through stuff with a narcissist. They're oftentimes having deep-seated attempts to get love and approval from others rather than criticism. They may be hypersensitive to criticism, so we're processing that in couples therapy. We also need to confront this idea of this over-idealized relationship, like a prince and a princess, and help each person take responsibility for their part. Now, I'd like you to listen to the audio associated with counseling a narcissist, and then come back and we're going to continue to talk next about borderline personality disorder. Now, as we talk about borderline personality disorder, we're going to look at what some of the elements of that are. When you think of a colleague saying, oh, he or she's borderline, what comes to your mind? Almost always we think pretty quickly about the affect dysregulation and the instability in interpersonal relationships. There oftentimes is self-destructive behavior. There might be cutting or harming, not necessarily always with intent to kill themselves, but there is a great deal of impulsivity. That's what can be very tricky about the borderline. And when we talk about things like self-harm, while borderlines may do self-harm more to manipulate or for attention-seeking, we also find that in overreacting and in having affect dysregulation, that oftentimes they end up really harming themselves in the process or even killing themselves. So that's why this borderline personality disorder is something that we have to be very delicate with. Borderlines tend to have distorted and maladaptive thinking about themselves and others. There's this love-hate relationship. If you look at the graphic on the PowerPoint, I thought that was so neat, where it's like a mirror, like love and hate are kind of just so close. It's such a thin line. that, you know, you could 1 second, if you're in a relationship with a borderline, be on their good side, you're, you know, someone they admire, and then all of a sudden they don't like you anymore. It's difficult for them to manage their emotional sensitivity to stimuli. They tend to have intense responses. They have difficulty regulating their emotions and difficulty just looking at things in terms of behavioral goals. Self-soothing is a real big challenge for them. That's something that we really need to work with the borderline on in terms of therapeutic techniques. Frequently, the borderline themselves will use words like they feel misunderstood, they feel hurt, they feel traumatized, they're confused, they just don't understand why certain things are happening the way they are, they feel blamed, alienated, and abandonment's a huge issue for borderline. Fear of abandonment. Again, it may or may not be real abandonment, but it may be imagined abandonment, is a huge issue for the borderline. Now, when you're on the receiving end of relating to the borderline, whether it be a family member or whether it be a clinician, you may feel confused, blamed. You might feel like the borderline's constantly trying to put guilt on you. One of the words I found in the literature to be very true is exasperated and exhausted. You may feel stuck and trapped because sometimes they can change on a dime. What triggers a borderline then? I mean, how can we work with someone with a long-term pervasive pattern if we don't know what triggers them? Well, the literature would suggest that in terms of a borderline, they have an intense fear of alienation from meaningful relationships. So it would be important to process with the borderline what makes for him or her a meaningful relationship. And then what can they do? What is their responsibility in a relationship? That is not just things that happen to them or things that people do to them, but the responsibilities they can have. Sometimes they have challenges with making use of support systems. They know when things are overwhelming, but to pause and stop and consider their resources, consider that they have choices in decision making, can be tough. They have difficulty learning from their life experiences. So oftentimes you'll see, as with any personality disorder, repeated patterns of behavior where you're thinking like, oh my gosh, you're telling me this relationship is so awful, it's not working out, it's toxic. But when you listen to their narrative, you're thinking, this is the same pattern that you've always used. A lot of times they jump from crisis to crisis to where sometimes when they're coming in saying they have such grief, but they're not seeing how crisis is ruling their life. They have low self-esteem, make quick decisions. A lot of times there's issues of drugs and alcohol or self-injurious behavior. They found in the literature that borderline personality disorder clients are actually physically hardwired to be extra emotional. Something happens with their brain. It's really interesting to see that their amygdala, which is the center of emotion in the brain, is overactive. They have a lack of understanding about why it just floods. So their baseline tends to be higher. So there actually is something that happens with the borderline. What happens from their environment then, besides the biology we just referred to, is that early on, there's invalidation. There's lack of symbiosis. When you look at a lot of their relationships, when you think of like infants and parents and attachment, a lot of times there's lack of symbiosis. And there's lack of teaching and role modeling with what to do with emotions. Oftentimes, people that are borderline have had extensive history of unresolved abuse and trauma. Sometimes the only way to regulate in their mind the tension is self-harm. So self-mutilation is oftentimes a thing that we see with borderlines. I would say that self-harm, whether it's cutting or burning, I've had people that have burnt and written words in their skin, people that have cut themselves, people that have hit themselves with objects, that it's basically impulsivity to the core. Self-soothing is tough. When we think someone's baseline is so high, it's very hard for them to self-soothe. This also points to the reason why in the literature, one of the highest regarded types of treatment for a borderline is mindfulness. Mindfulness helps the borderline just look at the immediate here and now in the moment. Borderline personality disorder doesn't just affect the borderline, but affects their family members and those around them, just like narcissism did when we talked about earlier. But one of the things they're finding out increasingly in the literature is that if we can work in terms of crisis intervention and therapy with the family and the systems around them, then it helps to sometimes cut borderline personality disorder off at the pass. Things we could do in treatment, for example, with family members is teaching them how to disengage. You know, when things are overwhelming and stressful like that, how do they pull back? How do they be supportive from a distance and within boundaries? How are they supposed to handle suicidal gestures? It's probably difficult for them to know when is this attention seeking, when is it just impulsivity, when is it a cry for help. How should they deal with mood swings and volatility? And how do they act on the receiving end of the anger or the grief of the borderline? The questions that families ultimately ask when we look at the literature is, how can we even survive being around this person? How can we help them? Oftentimes people in a relationship with a borderline feel like they must have done something wrong. That why is this person so emotionally dysregulated? Why can't I make this person happy? That no matter what I do, it's just never enough. Why do I always feel frustrated and worn out? How can I even take any more of this? Like I said, it's just really, really exhausting. So some of the literature increasingly is focusing on how do you help the borderline's family. One way is teaching self-care to these family members, helping them have education about the chronic pattern of borderline, helping them accept that this person with borderline personality disorder does have an issue with emotional dysregulation, and helping them understand what that means. Helping them to realize that this borderline that they're in relationship with is addicted to chaos, that they're desperate, that they're trying out different identities. The phrase the literature uses is chronic emptiness. There is a specific plan that the literature talks about in terms of what loved ones can do. This, I think, is very helpful because when you feel helpless dealing with the borderline, it's like, what can I even do? Nothing's going to ever make this stop. So first of all, they suggest that you clarify what happened. Get the facts. Borderlines tend to, because they're so emotionally dysregulated, be so focused on feelings, but move away from the facts. So one of the most helpful things our loved ones can do is refocus them back to, okay, well, what happened? I hear you saying you're angry. I hear you saying you feel things didn't go the way you want. You're ticked off. Let's talk about what happened. Then use active listening to understand. one of the key words that's repetitively said in the literature is validation. Now, let me clarify. Validation doesn't mean agreeing with the perception of the borderline. It means validating their feelings and concerns. So something like, wow, if I expected people to act that way and they totally did the opposite, I would feel like giving up. I would question things in relationships too. So sometimes try to put yourself in their shoes. Another thing I found interesting when I was studying for this seminar is the literature talked about the importance of the people in the borderline's life asking if it's okay to help them. A lot of times borderlines really don't want help. So actually asking, do you want help? Let them answer yes or no. If they say yes, what does the help look like? If the borderline person says they don't want help, just leave them space to try and de-escalate and not get in the middle of whatever they're doing then. So we can help the borderline's family by helping work through those things, helping them realize how they can cope with an acute area versus the chronic nature of the borderline. We can help them learn how to react to different instances that the borderline's experiencing. The family oftentimes is impacted by the borderline family member because they have that family stress. They're not sure if they should worry about the person, if they should try and dive in and problem solve. Should they take care of them? Should they just give up on them? They feel to blame. And sometimes the borderlines are good at putting that blame on them. There's a secondary trauma they experience. I mean, imagine being around someone just like any of us that counsel borderlines, you know, with the emotional dysregulation, what that does to you. So oftentimes family members also have mood disordered symptoms of some type. So there's this sense of, do I be sympathetic with the borderline? Do I just say I can't do this anymore? Do I involve other people? One of the particular challenges is when you're looking at couples issues and borderline personality. With that, we're looking at regulation of mood, impulsivity, and how to improve the quality of the interpersonal relationship. Oftentimes what we see is someone coming in because this borderline is like pulling to avoid either real or oftentimes imagined abandonment, that they're really freaking out. So we're instead we should be helping couples to develop competency, have a plan for access to resources and how to use them, and helping the borderline to address their own needs. One of the things the literature talks about is actually the importance of boundaries with borderlines, including a very detailed written therapist and patient or client agreement. They talk about the elements of this should include the aims or goals of therapy, the timing of how often sessions would be, the frequency of sessions, how billing will go, responding to crisis, and boundaries regarding their personal lives. One of the things that the literature also highlights is that for someone starting out as a therapist in the field, they may easily feel overwhelmed by a borderline personality client. So it's important for all of us to have clinical supervision, consultation, be very specific about our contract with the client, the policies, the procedures, spell things out, say them, reiterate them, write them. We can't reiterate it enough times. Don't underestimate the importance of Rogers process variables as a foundation. It's going to probably be a while when you're dealing with a borderline before you can do real detailed confrontation. So one of the things you have to be delicate about balancing is acceptance and change. Again, acceptance and validation being trying to relate to the underlying feelings, but not necessarily agreeing. Another thing that is important is to make sure that we manage countertransference. We can model emotional restraint. And that's one of the biggest things we can do in a relationship with a borderline. A lot of times inside, you might feel like screaming. You might feel like, oh my gosh, here we go again. But when we're role modeling restraint, that gives a chance eventually for the borderline to basically look and be like, how in the world did you act that way when I was screaming, when I was doing this? Then there also needs to be a plan for if hospitalization or inpatient is decided on, if there is a real crisis risk, because that is a real potential when you're working with borderlines. The things you don't want to do are pretending you understand, to agree or disagree with a borderline instead of just validating. And you don't want to solve the problem for them if that's not where they're at. Stay awake and alert when you're dealing with them. Ask questions to understand where they're coming from. Check in about them, what they're experiencing. Place their emotions in context. I think for me, that's one of the things that is most freeing, because it's so easy if I don't do this to think, wow, they're going off the deep end. But if I look at the narrative, then I can normalize, wow, they're feeling let down. They're really afraid of losing this relationship. They're concerned and worried about such and such. So one of the best things we can do as therapists is to get ourselves in control, to de-escalate. One of the things that as we teach skills for de-escalation and self-soothing is we can communicate and reassure the borderline that they are able to get back in control. What feels totally out of control isn't necessarily out of control, but that you're going to see them through this. Empathize and validate what you can. Use strength-based approaches. Let me give you an example of what validation is, just so you clearly understand what I'm saying. Look, I know that you see yourself as worthless and undeserving. The fact is you have done some things that have made you feel that way. And I know that your mistakes in life have made you feel bad about yourself. This is what I want you to know about yourself, though. Limits and boundary setting are important. It creates structure, and that really goes against that emotional unpredictability that they, you know, the borderline experiences. Accepting the here and now is another skill we want to teach a borderline. There's some therapies that in the literature are repeatedly highlighted. One of them is schema therapy. Remember, when we're talking about personality disorders, we're talking about long-term pervasive ways of approaching things. There's core themes. One is that the borderline needs to essentially be reparented. There oftentimes are issues about family of origin types of things. There's oftentimes they need to re-experience life stresses in a different way, restructure their thought patterns, or break toxic behaviors. There's oftentimes significant abuse or perceptions of abuse that we need to process through. Oftentimes there's grief over lack of healthy attachments. And so there may not be a concept to the borderline of what intimacy, real healthy intimacy, involves. So what we can do is we can identify what core needs are not adequately met by the caregivers. We can help them grieve and work through losses, help them find healthy ways for meeting needs now. We can give experiential techniques to retell the narrative in a restorative way, to enter into memories and images of family members through the years. If you've taught the skills already, you could do something like an empty chair exercise, like the Gestalt empty chair, to help them process and integrate different parts of themselves. Cognitively, we could validate emotions, but help them look at beliefs and behaviors and where those fit in, and then using cognitive debating skills. We could help with skill development. There's a number of great computer apps out there. There's role plays we can do. There's flashcards. There's different things out there that can help the borderline. Another thing that the literature highlights is mind-body therapy. Oftentimes, since there is such a high percentage of borderlines who have been through trauma, that the memories may be stored in their body. So we're helping them to de-escalate things like behavioral relaxation to help them to de-escalate when they're remembering those things. We're promoting things like spontaneity while playing, just learning to be, learning to enjoy life. One of the things that's most commonly talked about in the literature is DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. And so there's five areas of dysregulation that DBT addresses. It addresses affect dysregulation, behavior dysregulation, because keep in mind, if someone's feeling off, their actions are probably going to be, especially when they're impulsive, pretty off. The interpersonal dysregulation, self-dysregulation, and the thought patterns that are off. So what happens, there's two opposing factors inside the borderline. And so the response that the therapist can have in effective therapy is what the literature would call radical acceptance. This means in the moment that the client's just taking themselves as they are, the therapist is experiencing and accepting the fullness of what the client's going through and the therapeutic relationship in that moment. DBT principles, one of the key ones is mindfulness. We're enhancing the capability of the client to handle stress. So let's say a borderline is stressed out at home with a relationship issue. Let's say they're in the middle of cleaning the kitchen and they get super frustrated and irritable about a relationship issue. They can return through mindfulness to the here and now. If they're washing dishes, they can feel the water, the bubbles, the texture of the things they're holding in their hands. They can just look at what's happening right at the moment, as opposed to trying to take on all kinds of other stuff. DBT also highlights again this principle of validation, looking at why the client feels as he or she does, reinforcing telling themselves the whole truth, listening and observing, and putting behaviors again in context. Radical genuineness is another way that the literature talks about validating. It uses dialectical strategies, which has to do about the way we talk, the way we experience. So it helps someone to change, but also accepts at the same time some of the areas that are difficult for them. For example, if someone's struggling with self-harm, you might say, "You feel like harming yourself. Would you like for me to arrange for someone to take you to the hospital?" So with radical genuineness, we're helping the client accept what they're feeling, what they're thinking in the moment, but we're helping them change and move beyond the toxic ways of reacting. We're helping them finding meaning in the moment. We're helping them overcome what they call arbitrary references, toxic thought patterns like overgeneralizing, magnifying, or exaggerating negative things. We're helping them overcome inappropriate attribution of blame and responsibility to themselves or to others. We're helping them overcome things like name-calling, catastrophizing, and just hopeless predictions. One of the biggest things over time that DBT groups can do is they can reinforce skills. So oftentimes when we're talking about dialectical behavioral therapy, which in most literature is the treatment of choice for borderlines, there is individual therapy going on as well as DBT groups, because there's some skills that the DBT groups can reinforce and the group dynamics can help in a different way from that individual session. So what they do when you start DBT groups, there's going to be an extensive, very specific, pinpointed list of what the rules are, what the boundaries. So things like no dropouts. Once you're out for good. Each client must also be attending their individual therapy so they can process things that happen in the group. That people who attend the group should be free from drugs and alcohol. That attendees should not discuss parasuicidal behaviors outside of session. When they're suicidal, they should let the leader know and reach out for help. The group needs to be kept confidential. Changes in schedule need to be discussed ahead of time. And that members should not have relationships, dating, friendships, sexual partners with people within the group. The idea with DBT groups is that skills are not automatic for any of us. We're noticing what works and what doesn't work. And we're creating an environment for there to be willingness to learn without defensiveness. So the first part of what they would do in the group is define the skill to be learned. Then they would role model it, practice it, do some behavioral rehearsal, and talking about how do I keep this going outside the session, and then reinforcing it. So let's say if changing self-talk was the skill that they were talking about in a session, they would identify the barriers to healthy thinking. They would maybe give a handout on what the negative thought assumptions or attributions are. They would help people to self-evaluate that. Then the group leader may talk about how do you change self-talk? How do you identify and distinguish between feelings and thoughts? So there's different states of mind. There's the reasonable mind, the emotional mind, and the wise mind. When we're talking about DBT, the reasonable mind is logical. It pauses. It thinks through things logically and behavioral. It's a cool, calm, rational part. The emotional mind is the reactive, impulsive mind. This is the mind that's at work when people would see a borderline as dramatic or passionate or overreactive. A wise mind is an integration where someone's not just denying emotions. There is validation, but with that validation and with the experiencing of the emotions, there's a reasonableness. It's basically the calm after the storm. It's looking at the heart of what behaviors are desired. Things that are very useful to borderlines are things like differentiating between feelings and thoughts, dealing with perceptions. Oftentimes they perceive things to be a certain way that they may not be. Remember, there's a lot of fear that they have of relationships ending or of alienation. Another thing that can be taught is how to balance mastery and self-respect. So we're helping a client feel competent in their new skills, but also have self-respect. When should they fight for things? When should they set boundaries? When should they back away? One of the exercises you might also do with a borderline is helping them recognize, describe, and name their emotions. Looking at the events that cause certain emotions, how they interpret it, what their body language is, and their body responses. Verbally communicating about what's going on inside of them to others and what they need. And then what urges they have to take actions, but the choices they make ultimately. Sometimes the things that sound the most common sense and simple are the things we need to highlight to create some normalcy with the borderline. They use this phrase, please master. So encouraging them, if there are medical issues or health problems, treat the physical illness. Balance with healthy eating. Get sleep or exercise. And avoid mind-altering drugs. Create imagery of a safe place. When I've dealt with clients about that, it's important to involve all their senses. What can they see that's calming? What do they feel that's helping de-escalate them? This is great to be paired with mindfulness, because with mindfulness, they're just doing one thing in the moment. They're not taking on everything. If they're washing the dishes, they're just noticing the bubbles and the water between their hands. If they're sweeping the floor, they feel the feeling of the mop brushing against the floor. If they're going for a walk, they feel the breeze. If they're showering before work, feel the water on your skin. One of the things the literature suggests that is also a struggle for borderlines is what is termed mentalization. Just like we talked about narcissists having a hard time empathizing or putting themselves in someone else's shoes and what they're experiencing, borderlines also have a problem with mentalization. They have a real difficulty forming a realistic picture of what someone else is thinking or feeling. Context is something that's difficult for them. They may make judgments based on what they feel, but have difficulty gauging someone's motive. So they're predisposed to be distrustful and have these intensive fears that may or may not really be supported. So the best thing we can do is help correct some of those errors with mentalizing. We can help them instead of inferring mental states of other people that may not be correct to really test them. What happens is because of the schemas that they live with, the ways of thinking and perceiving things, even from a young age on, borderlines tend to fear failure, alienation, and abandonment. And a lot of this is linked to poor mentalizing. They don't look at other cues and context. So some of the errors they make are they're overly analytic. Their stories can serve to keep their fears of failure, alienation, and abandonment going. They have challenges dealing with affect and difficulty taking perspective. So we can actually teach them skills of how to really look at people's affective states. We can look at how to not just jump to conclusions or to misread other people's mind. How to really find out from the other through perspective taking, through looking at context, what the other person might be going through. If the skill mentalization can be taught to a borderline, we see a drastic decrease in impulsivity, self-mutilation, and suicidality. Because we're talking about long-term pervasive patterns, sometimes psychodynamic therapy can be useful also for borderlines. We can look at their emotions and the transference. We can look at the object representations. There may be some ways they act out things in therapy with us as attachment figures and issues regarding defenses that we can take a look at. What does a borderline want to know? First of all, in therapy, they want to know, they may not say these directly, but they want to know, can I be safe here? Will the therapist provide nurturance and support I desperately want and need? Or will he or she be cold, humiliating, or rejecting? Will the therapist support my decision making? Or will he or she take away my autonomy and sense of self through infantilizing or mothering or parenting me? Will the therapist be able to contain my neediness and rage? Or will I end up just destroying them? So can I be safe here? That's why our emotional regulation and what we role model to a client is key. Another question that the borderline's looking at is, do I have a right to be angry? They're wondering, why was I unloved? Am I unlovable? Am I to blame? Are my wants, needs, and opinions legitimate, or am I just crazy? This is one of the biggest areas that takes time to process through. They're also wondering if they're worthwhile. Then, are they ready to leave? Are they able to process things on their own without the effects of either the DBT group, the counselor? Cognitive behavioral therapies are helpful also for someone with borderline personality disorder. Cognitive behavioral therapies could either work with the borderline or with the family members or both. These would stress the importance of interpretation and thoughts in determining how feelings and behaviors are processed. And so identifying irrational thoughts and beliefs and behaviors that are not helpful. And then teaching ways of reorganizing the thoughts, changing undesirable feelings by changing beliefs and thoughts, and having better behavior choices. So it is possible for a borderline to change his or her thoughts. It may take time, but initially, if we identify some of their cognitive myths, we hear things like, I can't stand it if someone's upset with me. If someone says no to me, it'll kill me. I don't deserve to get what I want or need. If I make a request, I'm a weak person. I must be inadequate if I can't fix this myself. I have to know if a person will say yes before I make a request. Making a request is pushy and self-centered. Doesn't make a difference. I don't really care. Obviously, the problem is just in my head. If I would just think differently, I wouldn't have to bother anyone. It's a catastrophe, a disaster. Saying no is selfish. I should sacrifice myself. Those are the things we often have the borderline coming into us with. But over time, if we use these cognitive skills, we can help affirm positive behaviors and thought patterns. Things like, it's okay to want or need something from someone else. I have a choice to ask someone for what I want or need. The fact that someone says no to my request doesn't mean I should not have asked in the first place. If I didn't get my objectives, that doesn't mean I didn't go about it in a skillful way. Standing up for myself over small things can be just as important as big things. And I can insist on my rights and still be a good person. I can validate other people, but I can still ask for what I want. I can want to please people, but I don't have to please them all the time. Giving, giving, giving is not the be-all of life. I am an important person too. If I refuse to do a favor for people, that doesn't mean I don't like them. They'll probably understand that. I'm under no obligation to be everything to everybody. If I say no to people and they get angry, that doesn't mean that I should have said yes. And finally, I can still feel good about myself, even though someone is annoyed with me. So over time, it's important to help the borderline develop this new sense of self. really we're talking about the fact that they're really not sure who they are. That's part of the reason why there's this erratic emotional display. They actually gave in the literature, which I thought was neat, a list of questions you could give a borderline to help them self-evaluate. Can this other person I'm in relationship with give me what I want? Is it good for me to ask? Am I prepared? Is what this person does really my business? Do I have a right to what I'm asking for? Is the request appropriate to the relationship? Am I asking less than I give? Is asking important to a long-term goal? And am I acting competent? And then you can use those same questions to look at responding to others' requests. The best way to approach borderlines is through a multidisciplinary team approach. The more different types of providers, whether it be nurses and doctors, therapists, others, the better that these skills are going to be reinforced. So one of the things that we need to do is really pull together as a team to teach problem solving, to help them methodically think through their choices and actions. What is the problem? What are the facts? What are the different possible solutions? And then imagine the results of those solutions. There's a model in the literature called the SET model. The SET model. Each of those letters stand for something. S is support, E is empathy, and T is truth. S, I want to help you. So you hear the support in that. E, this must be very difficult for you. T, when such and such happens, it communicates blank to you. You need such and such. So you start with the feelings because that's what the borderline is experiencing. Usually the intense feelings are where we start with. But then we're moving to facts and reality. What's going to help a borderline work through is reconstructing the behaviors. The building blocks of narcissistic and borderline clients have to do with attachments. There's a lot of literature out there that says both the narcissist and the borderlines have had adults devalue or cut them off and minimize their needs. They've also had preoccupied or entangled relationships where they've been so intense but then had difficulty detaching emotionally from others. They might have grown up in a family system where children were punished for emotional displays by rejection and attention or exasperation. So sometimes the fears that they have are based in part on some reality. They might have been in a family system where parents frightened their children and used fear against them. They might have been in a family system where there was rapidly switching reactions and emotions. Imagine what that would have done to someone growing up in that. So there's a sense it's better to be in a predictably unhealthy relationship than no relationships. And there's this idea that I'm miserable because other people are making me miserable. What I'd like you to do is go to the audio on counseling a borderline. Now we're going to continue about a histrionic personality disorder. I don't have a ton on this, just because a lot of times we don't always see these coming in, but there's a lot of overlap between the histrionic and the borderline, and then some narcissism in there too. Again, when we're talking about cluster B personality disorders, we're talking about some commonalities. A histrionic person is excessively attention-seeking. So you see where that could relate to some narcissism. But they're very emotional. they might present with a great deal of sexual seductiveness or theatricality. So what we want to do is help their communication style, look and identify patterns and schemas. So using a lot of those similar techniques to what we talked about in terms of schema therapy with borderlines. Our therapies should use techniques that were like what we talked about with borderline. We need to highlight boundary setting with the histrionic and involve other staff when needed. And the reason I mentioned that involving other staff is because a lot of times there is a hypersexuality or seductiveness. So in terms of ethics and boundary setting, that can be really important. Now, please listen to the audio of therapy with a histrionic personality. We're going to wrap up here today by looking at antisocial personality disorder. What are some of the signs or marks of antisocial personality? Well, oftentimes we see people with a temper or rage. So again, there's some lack of emotional regulation. So emotional dysregulation oftentimes is a quality of all the cluster B personality disorders. Antisocial personality clients may have harm to other people or belongings without remorse. They might hurt pets. They might harm people. They might have disrespect for authority. When you really look at support systems and assess that, a lot of times you find that an antisocial person really doesn't have close friends. So one thing that's missing from basically all of these cluster B personality disorders is the lack of genuine intimacy. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of times antisocial personalities could care less about having friends. They brag about not needing anyone. In relationships, they use skills like intimidation, competition, scams. They might do something bad because they feel like it benefits them. So in that respect, they may present somewhat looking like a narcissist. They might do something kind, but the person around them really needs to beware, because it's not necessarily that they're choosing to just be kind, but it might be more that they're trying to manipulate other people. Rules don't count for them. So a lot of times we see childhood origins of antisocial personality. You might see a child with impulsivity, low intelligence. You might see someone who doesn't have a lot of parental supervision, or they're role modeling toxic things that they see among the parents and adults in their life. Again, we see, just like with a borderline, an extensive history of people who have been on the receiving end of abuse that become antisocial. Oftentimes, with antisocials, it's specifically physical abuse. They may have been on the result of, or the receiving end of, the punitive parental discipline. A lot of times, if they do have quote-unquote friends or people they hang around, they're also relatively antisocial. And there's a history of delinquency. They might live in high-crime areas. So we're looking at community programs as one of the areas that kind of helps with the antisocial personality. The more that we can change the community, they can have role models that they can identify with, that there's accountability for specific behaviors, the more hope we can have for change with the antisocial. If you look at the pyramid I have, there's a progression of behavioral acting out. Initially, it might start at a younger age, like preschool or young elementary school, with the oppositional defiant behaviors, basically not dealing with hearing no, having their way, not respecting authority, and then progressing to conduct disordered, to where not only are they oppositional, but they start to develop some of those traits of actually defying authority. you might see someone start to get involved in the court system, being on probation, getting in trouble for truancy or school-related issues, and then eventually a small population of those progress to antisocial behavior. There are actually some treatment approaches for antisocial personality. I know this may surprise you because a lot of times when I talk with colleagues, they tend to think like, yeah, it's not that likely they can turn around. But there are some things in the research literature. One of the approaches is have the antisocial personality disordered person put himself in the victim role. The literature shows that antisocial personality clients generally are not very empathic. Again, this whole mentalization thing, they tend to misperceive how things are experienced by the victim. So helping them to look at that is important. Helping them focus on the consequences of their choices. They may not feel bad about what they do, but if we just stick to consequences, okay, so living on the streets, not having any support systems, losing your car, losing your house, losing your job. We can also do therapy that looks at the core schemas or rules. We can help restructure painful memories and use a lot of cognitive behavioral sort of therapy to retrain behaviors. So a lot of what we talked about before with borderlines and others about identifying toxic thoughts and actually just teaching almost methodically what new healthy behaviors are. Sometimes because the family system has been so hurt, if it would be safe, sometimes it's helpful to deal with a systems approach. So the schemas that we need to look at when we're working with someone who is antisocial is their attributions about self or other, their ideas about what actions get what results, how they get the goals that they want, their appraisals of self and others, their interpretation about things. One of the things we find repeatedly with antisocial people is that they tend to attribute neutral stimuli as if they are hostile. You can give a series of pictures to people that are antisocial, and things that are neutral, they'll create a whole story about, oh, this person was out to get me, they were doing this, they looked this way, oh, they were staring at me because whatever. So we found out that aggressive clients tend to attribute hostile attributions to others. So if someone's looking my way and they're staring and I'm antisocial, I might think, oh, they're staring at me. What, they have a problem with me? They don't like the way I look? Whereas it might not even be that. It might be they're waiting for their ride. It might be there's someone behind me or near me that they're looking at. There could be so many other neutral explanations. When things are ambiguous, even faces that were not angry, but sad or anxious faces, antisocial people tended to interpret sad and anxious faces as angry as well. They make inferences that are more hostile. They struggle with empathy and perspective taking. So again, we could use similar skills to what I said earlier with some of the other disorders. Using things like the I message. I feel such and such because such and such is happening. This is what I'd like in the future. And look at healthy behaviors. A lot of times when antisocial personalities are coming to us, they're oftentimes coming because they're mandated or they're court involved. So the things that we need to look at and deal with them in terms of therapy are to deal with what is a deterrent, if anything, to them about crime. Why have the desire for control over others? What is it about being self-serving? What is it about power that keeps them doing what they're doing? There tends to be thought patterns and errors that antisocial people have. Deterrents or things that would be a deterrent for me and you might not be a deterrent to them. Going to jail? They might say, oh heck, I've been in jail before several times. I can handle it again. I even had one guy tell me one time that he said, well, I might be better off in jail. At least I get food, at least I have shelter. You know, I don't know that I'm fit for society, is what he said. Thought patterns, that they have to be in control all the time, that they have to look at what's self-serving. There may be a sense of blaming others or rationalizing things, lack of empathy, lack of focus on the context of things. So when you're working with antisocial personalities, there's a question of, is this someone who can be rehabilitated? Why are they here? Is this a criminal justice issue or is this a mental health issue? Do they really want help? Do they want an alternative understanding of the problem? So is this someone who lacks skills or maybe was mistaught things or whose environment reinforced the toxic hostile attributions of stuff? Can they be retrained? Then we look at where is the line between offenders' rights and public protection. Can pro-social behavior really demonstrate an ability to apply pro-social behaviors on an ongoing basis? So the tricky thing that the literature with antisocials ask is, since antisocial personality disorders can be manipulative, are they able to act like their behavior's changed? Are they able to say the right things, to say they're rehabilitated, that they have had this enlightening experience, that they're not going to do certain things again, only for them to just get out of jail or prison, but really not have an intention of changing? So there's a lot of considerations here. But on the other hand, there's an article I cite in which the author says, it cannot be overstated that if you deny offenders the chance to be responsible, you cannot blame them for behaving badly. Fact of the matter is, a relatively small group of offenders and families are responsible for a disproportionate amount of crime. 7.8% of families produce 51% of arrests. So it's not necessarily true that a huge proportion of antisocial personality disorder people are all criminals. There's a group of them that might be considered what we call socio or psychopaths, who really do criminal behavior. But just because someone's antisocial doesn't mean they're necessarily a psychopath. There's some key questions you can use that could work with an antisocial in therapy. One, when you do not have full control of your life, what kinds of feelings happen? Two, you will not tolerate these feelings then? And three, what is the next step then? One of the therapies, which I found really interesting, I hadn't heard of before studying for this seminar, is called agitation therapy. This would have to be done very delicately. This is meant for people who are very problematic and aggressive, who do not respond to other psychotherapies. So this is pretty much a last resort. And it's looking at, how do I expose this antisocial person to things that might agitate them while helping them learn to deal with their anger? This is not supposed to be the only skill you use with them. So you're supposed to have taught other foundations. Again, the criteria for using this is, it should be voluntary. You should not be using it with a client who has excessive manipulative behavior. They should be stable enough to cope with situations in therapy, have some social support network, and wish to be treated. it's not suitable for those who are extremely aggressive, defensive, or paranoid. Those who are dominating, violating, or manipulative. Those with comorbid psychosis, borderline, paranoid, or ADHD symptoms. Those without reality testing or under influence of substances. So, one of the things I'd like you to do is listen to the audio now about counseling and antisocial personality. As we're wrapping up, I just wanted to give some general things from the literature about personality disorders, just to highlight some things that can be used. When we're assessing personality disorders, again, we're talking about long-term pervasive patterns across a number of situations that have likely occurred at a young age, been reinforced by environment, and probably some biology as well. So it's good to have a combination of an unstructured interview, some information with collaterals like family members, treating professionals, court, probation officers, schools, and if possible, what's a nice supplement is to have some standardized psych testing. Things like the Milan Personality Interview, the Personality Assessment Inventory, or the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. We don't want to use any one of those assessment tools in isolation. The key is there's defense mechanisms that personality disorders use, and we need to look at those. Another thing the literature highlights is not just treating the person with the personality disorder, but providing supports for the collateral. So family treatment of personality disorders is talked about in the literature. This can help people deal with the situational and contextual factors. What are the triggers for this client? It can help look at behaviors, schemas that might have been developed over time that might need to be changed. It can provide education. It can look at ongoing interactive patterns, what they desire to happen and how we can help shape that. We can help, though it may take some time, to do some schema reconstruction. We can help behavior management. Listen to all the different types of behaviors that we can do in terms of behavior goals, either with the client or with the family. We can teach things like anger management. We can teach the difference between passive, aggressive, and assertive behaviors and reinforce healthy assertiveness. We can do empathy training, as we talked about before, impulse control training, building interpersonal skills, self-regulation and soothing, and thought identification, stopping and changing. A systems approach is highly recommended because personality is shaped by our early experiences. It's shaped by the nature of the attachments we have. It's shaped by our defense mechanisms and others' reactions to them. It's reinforced by environmental and cultural variables. People do ask the question about use of medication, so I did want to address this and not just brush over it. Medication may be an adjunct to therapy for cluster B disorders. What happens is, oftentimes you have co-occurring mood symptoms with someone with a personality disorder. Things like paranoia, things like impulsivity, depression, mood swings, anxiety. Those types of things might be able to be medicated. But long-term defense mechanisms, errors in thoughts, things that have been reinforced like the schemas, are not necessarily things you're going to medicate. Those are skills that need to be taught and built throughout counseling. So the mood aspects are things that medication would control. I actually will tell clients when they talk about medication as an option that medication may help some of the mood issues, but it's not going to necessarily teach the skills that need to be taught. And that's why medication and therapy can work hand in hand sometimes. So one of the things we look at is that with personality disorders, they're globally more chaotic and difficult to treat than Axis 1 disorders. So if you are a clinician that's listening to this seminar that either now is dealing with Cluster B personality disorder clients, or if you plan to be in the future, expect a long road ahead. Be realistic about it. You're going to be taking baby steps with a person. And as we talked about, controlling your own emotions, regulating mindfulness, self-care for yourself is going to be key. Having a good support system of colleagues. One of the things the literature shows is even with extensive treatment for any of these Cluster B personality disorders, 5 years post-treatment, people with Cluster B personality disorders still are far more symptomatic than other types of disorders. So the fact is, when we're talking about long-term, pervasive things that have been across years and situations and reinforced, it's really hard to change those patterns. It's not impossible for there to be some skill identification and building. It's not impossible for there to be some change, but it's important for us to go in with a realistic idea about that. And again, make sure that we have other colleagues, supervisors, and people in the field, really a multidisciplinary approach to where we can be helped, kept in check, and receive the support we need as we're working with these Cluster B personality disorders. Thank you for joining me for this seminar on Cluster B personality disorders. Please make sure if you haven't already listened to the audios associated with this seminar for the audio role plays that you do so, and then take the self home study test. Thank you.